following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
Everything rises and falls on leadership. So says John Maxwell, former pastor and one of the world's leading, most sought-after experts in the business world on the subject of leadership. I think it'd be a safe bet that everyone in here could give examples of seeing that principle in action. Everything rises and falls on leadership. We've all experienced situations where good things happen because of good leadership. We've probably all experienced where bad things happen because of poor leadership. Amen? If nothing else, the past few years, and I dare say the past few days, we have seen multiple examples of this on the national scene of what can happen or the importance of good leadership. God's people need good leaders as well. If we're going to accomplish the mission that God has given us, if we're going to make new disciples and expand the influence of God's kingdom here in this community and around the world, we need people who can inspire others, who can organize people, who can motivate them and move them in the right direction to accomplishing the mission. However, God's ideas about leadership are often a little different than the ideas of leadership that most of our world believes in. For one thing, God has a history of choosing the most unlikely people to provide leadership for His people. These figures include shepherds, commercial fishermen, former prosecutors, enemies, to name a few. People whom God has taken and pulled out and equipped and turned loose to lead His people. In the Bible, we also see that a leader's character is just as important, perhaps even more important, than a leader's charisma or competence. Think of a figure like Saul, Israel's first king. Saul had a lot of charisma. People flocked to him. He had a fair amount of competence too. He had a long, in many ways, successful reign. But the defects in Saul's character ultimately caused him to lead his people into a terrible disaster. And you contrast that with a successor, David. There was nothing about David early on that impressed anybody. Not even David's own father didn't even think to call David in from the sheep when the prophet Samuel came looking to anoint a new king. And yet, David went on, because he had a heart that pursued God, David went on to be the most successful king, arguably, that Israel ever had. He became the model for all good kings in Israel. One of the most interesting leaders portrayed for us in the Bible is a man who played a big role in the period that we've been looking at the last several weeks. We've already examined how these waves of refugees who had been in exile in Babylon and Persia began to move back into Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and rebuild the city. First wave came after the Jews had spent about 50 to 70 years in exile in Babylon. And then there was a second wave led by Ezra the scribe that we've talked about the last few weeks that took place about 70, 80 years after that. And here we are 13 years or so after Ezra. We see another wave coming under the leadership of a man named Nehemiah. Nehemiah has often been held up as a model for leadership. In fact, back in the late 70s, Chuck Swindoll wrote a best-selling book about leadership using Nehemiah as his model. It's called Hand Me Another Brick. Maybe some of you all read that book. I'd encourage you, even though it was written in the late 70s, there's still a lot in that book that speaks today. It's amazing how, even though the particulars of the late 70s have changed to 2021, some of the general principles are still the same. I'm rereading that book right now as I prepare for this study. And I encourage you to go back and, if you've never read it, to maybe give it a look. But as we continue to think about how to rebuild the house of God coming out of this time of disruption that we are in right now, we're going to spend a few weeks tracing Nehemiah's story and seeking to learn from his example. And at the very least, Nehemiah shows us what we should look for in leaders. He also says there's a few things that we should look out for, because Nehemiah wasn't perfect. He had his flaws just like the rest of us. But he shows us some things we should look for and aspire to in leadership. And maybe also that the Lord uses this story to encourage some of you to step out in faith and to accept the mantle of leadership, to be involved in leading the people of God into the future. Our study begins in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. Going to go into the first three verses of chapter 2. I encourage you, if you have a Bible, to open up so you can follow along. But as we are looking at the story of Nehemiah and learning how to rebuild the house of God, we need leaders like Nehemiah. We need leaders that are sensitive to needs beyond their own immediate circumstances. In chapter 1, verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They said to me, "The remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire." This book is introduced as Nehemiah's own words. Now, if you'll bear with me for just a minute, I'm going to have to focus on a little background here that help us understand all of this, but I promise you we're going to get to all these points in short order. With just a few exceptions, most of the story is told in the first person. It may be the original core of this book was actually from the journal of Nehemiah himself. As we're introduced to Nehemiah, we're told only a few details about him. First, we're told he was the son of Hakaliah, about whom we know nothing else. We also know that Nehemiah was Jewish, but because of his father's name and his name. His name in Hebrew means Yah comforts. And Yah is the shortened version of that personal name of God that God revealed to Moses at the burning bush that was so special and treated with such reverence by the Jewish people. Nehemiah's name actually incorporates that name, God comforts. And that was Nehemiah's role. His task was to bring comfort to God's people in the midst of this terrible situation they were in. We also know he's Jewish because he refers to these people traveling back and forth from Jerusalem as his kinsmen. Hanani may have actually been his brother or may have been a cousin or something, but he had some kinship with this man and these men who were traveling back and forth between Susa and Jerusalem. Nehemiah's story, we find out, is set in the 20th year of the reign of the Persian king Artaxerxes. That places him about 13 to 14 years after Ezra, whom we talked about the last couple of weeks. By our reckoning, that would be around 445 B.C. For those of you who study history, if you're looking for a place to hang this is about a decade before the start of the Peloponnesian War in Greece. This is when this is taking place. And that year is significant, 445 B.C., because it was during a period of upheaval and uncertainty in Artaxerxes' rule. Just a few years after Artaxerxes came to the throne, there was a major revolt in Egypt that had disrupted the Persian Empire, and he'd had to put down that revolt. Just three years earlier, there was an important governor who led a rebellion affecting the region of the empire where Judah was located, what was known as the Transjordan region. And that, again, Artaxerxes had to stop and turn and put down that rebellion. And because of trouble like this, Artaxerxes would have had an interest in promoting stability and political loyalty in Judah as a buffer against the troubles in Egypt and of settling down that Transjordan region. We're told Nehemiah lived in Susa, which was the winter capital of the Persian Empire. The Persian kings were, because of the climate, is so inhospitable in that part of the world, they would move their capital depending on what time of year it was. They had a capital set up in the mountains where they would go during the summer where it was cooler. And then in the wintertime, they'd come down to Susa where it was generally more mild. Kind of like my grandfather used to do. He'd spend his winters in Daytona and his summers in Chattanooga. That's how the Persian kings operated to deal with the climate there. Politically and culturally, Nehemiah lived a great distance from Jerusalem. It was 800 miles geographically, which is not insignificant. But politically and culturally, these two cities couldn't have been any more different. Susa, the capital of the most powerful empire in the world at that time, and Jerusalem, which was nowhere. Interestingly, there's another very important detail about Nehemiah that he omits until we get to the end of chapter 1. But we're going to go ahead and look at that. Nehemiah holds this out until he establishes the main problem this story is going to deal with. But we can go ahead and jump to that, to the end of verse 11. And after Nehemiah tells us how he learned about the situation in Jerusalem and how he sought the Lord's guidance on how to deal with that problem, only then does he inform us that he himself is in a position to actually be able to do something about that situation. At the end of chapter 11, the very last line, Nehemiah identifies himself as the cupbearer of the king. Now, why is that important? Well, the cupbearer was something like a butler. He would have attended to the king's personal needs. His most important task was to check the king's food and drink as it was served to him to make sure nobody was trying to poison the king. Nehemiah would have tasted the food and tasted the drink. The steward would hand it to Nehemiah. Nehemiah would sample it. If he didn't die, it was okay for the king to eat and drink it. Because the cupbearer spent a lot of time in the king's personal presence and a lot of close contact, and because this job required a high degree of trust on the part of the king, cupbearers came to hold a high degree of influence in the royal court. And we know from other sources in history of situations where cupbearers would, augment their income by taking bribes to whisper little things in the king's ear, to drop little hints. Or, king, hey, why don't you elevate this person, hire this person for this job, or why don't you send your troops over here? The cupbearers had a very important role in the royal court in Persia. Now, Nehemiah tells us in this narrative how he learned of a troubling situation in Jerusalem. And Nehemiah, according to verse 2, learns of this situation. This gets to our first point here, because he took the initiative to inquire about what was happening in the city of his ancestors. Remember, Nehemiah is living a long way away from Jerusalem. He's got a pretty nice life carved out for himself there. He's never even probably been to Jerusalem. He's 800 miles away. He's in the very center of power in the Persian Empire. And Jerusalem, that's nothing but a broken down backwater. And Nehemiah had spent his entire life under the rule of the Persian Empire. And he could have just gone about his business, collected his paycheck, and everything would have been fine. And yet, Nehemiah reaches out to his kinsmen, and he specifically inquires about the conditions in Jerusalem and about his fellow Jews who had resettled there. And what Nehemiah learned concerned him. The refugees, we're told, were in distress. In other words, life in Jerusalem was hard. They're also under reproach. In other words, they were being threatened by their neighbors. And in the early part of Ezra's book, we saw the form some of that persecution took. They were in a bad neighborhood with a lot of neighbors who hated their guts. The walls, we're told, the walls of the city were broken down. Now, that's a big deal. In the ancient world, almost every city had walls. In fact, the only major ancient city I know of that didn't have walls was the city of Sparta in Greece, because the Spartans believed their army were their walls. You know, the Spartans were so bad and had such a reputation, nobody was going to mess with the Spartans, so they never built walls around the city until much, much later, after the army had shrunk to the point it couldn't defend the city. But every other city had walls. Walls represented protection, because this was a violent world. Wars and rumors of wars, bandits, thieves. You built walls to protect your city. Walls were also a source of prestige. The more powerful your walls, the better reputation your city had. It's kind of like cities today build parks and things like that, or baseball stadiums, because they want to impress everybody else. In the ancient world, you want to impress everybody else, you build a great big wall around your city. And Jerusalem had no wall. In fact, the wall it had had originally had been torn down. It was an embarrassment and a disgrace, and it left the city defenseless. Now, you contrast Nehemiah's concern with that situation in a city he had never even been to with the attitude of a lot of people today. There's an expression that's really popular today. You see it on t-shirts, you see it on memes. Not my circus, not my monkeys. Now, on the one hand, there's a little wisdom to that, okay? If you follow that perspective, that attitude can keep you out of a lot of drama. Just mind your own business, right? But there's a negative side to that. because it keeps us from being concerned about things where we could make a difference. There's actually been research studies conducted into why bystanders are often hesitant to intervene, or in a lot of cases even report a person being victimized by a crime. Because people are saying, it's not my business. And so people suffer because other people refuse to get involved. Jesus told a parable about this, the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. Jesus actually criticized in that parable a couple of religious leaders who refused to stop and check on a man who'd been mugged. And then Jesus praises a man who was a social outcast who not only stopped to check on the man, but he paid for the man's medical care out of his own pocket. Basically gave his credit card to an innkeeper and said, take care of this man and I'll come settle up when I come back through here. And Jesus holds that man up as an example for the rest of us. Who's your neighbor? It's this person you come across in need that you can help. As Nehemiah demonstrates, we need leaders who will get out of their silos and become aware of the needs around them, to be concerned about what's happening, to let themselves be moved by the plight of other people and to figure out ways they can help alleviate that suffering. This leads into the next point. We need leaders who are characterized by compassion. In verse 4, when he learns about this situation, Nehemiah says, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. So when Nehemiah heard about this, he didn't just simply shrug the problem off. He didn't say, man, that's a long way away. There's nothing I can do. Those people are on their own. No, he was moved. He was moved personally by what was happening in the city of his ancestors. He stopped what he was doing. He was a busy man, but he took time off. He mourned. For days, we're told. I saw something this week. A lot of us have been passing along things on social media about praying for the people of Afghanistan. And somebody remarked on one of those I saw, all of you are passing around this request to pray for the people of Afghanistan. How many of you have actually stopped and done it? How many of us have allowed our schedules to be interrupted to actually mourn for people who are suffering? Nehemiah mourns for these people. He was willing to invest his own heart in the struggle of other people. Now, there's something I learned as a young leader. I haven't always exemplified it perfectly, but it's a principle I picked up from Zig Ziglar years ago. And I don't think he originated it. He's the one that I found out about it through. It basically says this: people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. Okay, and I have found that is so true. I wish I practiced that a lot more consistently than I do. With my personality and the way my brain works, the easiest thing in the world for me to do would be to lock myself in my office all week studying. Okay, and I know guys who do that. But I also know this, that if I don't ever come out and spend time with you, then all the preaching in the world, brilliant insights I could come up with, would be meaningless. And I dare say it's, and I'm not holding myself up as some kind of perfect example because I don't, I get this wrong too. But it's people that I have walked with through times of adversity that I have put an arm around a shoulder and cried with. Maybe people that at first we didn't see eye to eye. But because we walked those paths of adversity and suffering together, they are now some of my most valuable partners in ministry because we spent that time together. Leaders need to suffer with people. Need to enter that suffering just as Jesus entered our suffering. People don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. Nehemiah was moved by the plight of his people. In the middle of the situation, he is mourning for what's going on in Jerusalem. He also looks to God for guidance. And we need leaders who will do that. The latter part of verse 4, he says, I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I said, I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes be open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I'm praying before you now, day and night, and on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, that which we have sinned against you, I and my father's house have sinned. So after learning about the problems in Jerusalem, Nehemiah intentionally seeks the Lord's help through fasting and prayer. For those of you who don't know, fasting is doing without food for the purpose of seeking God. Okay, you say, instead of eating this meal, I'm going to pray. Whenever I feel those hunger pains, that's my cue. God, hear my voice. Now, you're going to be pretty concerned about something. You're going to be pretty serious about an issue to be willing to go without food in order to pray. I look around. There's a lot of us haven't missed a whole lot of meals. Okay? Maybe some, you know, people like me, maybe we need to spend a little more time in prayer. But he was so concerned, he fasted and sought the Lord to intervene. He also recognized God's sovereignty over this situation as he sought the Lord's help. He addresses God as the God of heaven. Now, actually, that was a Persian way of describing God, okay? A way which the Jews kind of assimilated into their conceptions of God. The Persians were what were called henotheists. That means they believed in many gods, but they believed that there was one God who reigned supreme. They called this being Ahura Mazda, or the wise Lord. Also referred to him as the God of heaven. The Jews, in contrast, were monotheists. They believed that only one God existed. And so because this God was the creator of all, and everything exists because of his word, and he sustains all of it, they believe he had left glimpses of himself throughout this creation. God's fingerprints are all over his creation. They also believed that because God created every human being in his image, there was a little reflection of God in our souls, warped, corrupted by our sin, yes, but it's still there. And so what that means is, because God was the creator of all, he left glimpses of himself in other cultures, even pagan cultures could stumble upon knowledge of God that happened to be correct, even if incomplete. We see this in Paul. And Paul, in Acts 17, is preaching to the Greek philosophers in Athens. He mentions that God created all things, and in him we live and exist and have our being. And he talked about how people, you know, they kind of grope in the darkness looking for God, and they might find little glimpses of God in the creation. But it takes God's direct and special revelation of himself, God's disclosure of himself, to really bring us to reconciliation with him, which is how the Jews saw themselves as the people whom God had selected as his own, whom he had spoken his word to. They were the ones that could fill in the gaps and tell everybody else in the world, this, the God you're kind of poking around in the dark looking for, this is the God who really is. And so when they came across this conception, God of heaven, they said, hey, that's the God we've been worshiping all along. And so they began to refer to him as the God of heaven as well. We see the same thing back in Genesis when Abraham met Melchizedek, the king of Salem, who was a priest of God Most High. The very next verse, what do we see? Abraham is referring to God Most High. So truth is truth no matter where you find it. You bring it into the service of God. I know people that say if it's not explicitly mentioned in the Bible, then I'm not going to accept it. It's funny. Most of these people drive cars. I only found one place in the Bible where cars are mentioned. The book of Acts, it says the church was all in one accord. If you think that's really about a car, you and I need to have a talk. But truth is truth, no matter where we find it. All truth belongs to God. And we understand that truth that we find out in the world through the truth God has given through his word. That's how we define and recognize that truth, by measuring it against the word. So he calls out to the God of heaven, and he begs God to intervene on the basis of two things. First, in verse 5, we see he intervenes on the basis of God's character, because this is the kind of God you are, and also God's covenant with the people of Israel. God, you promised this, that if we would turn and seek you, you would rescue us. And on top of that, Nehemiah does what we need leaders to do. He was prepared to take responsibility for the situation. In verse 6, he starts to confess the sins of the sons of Israel. And he identifies with those. He says, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. So as Nehemiah prayed, he confessed the sin that had led his people to be in this exile in the first place. Now remember, this exile had started over 140 years before. Nehemiah wasn't even born. Jerusalem had fallen to the Babylonians in 587 BC. The Jews had spent about 50 or so years prisoners of the Babylonians, and then they began under the Persian king Cyrus. They began to return to Jerusalem after that, and they'd been in Jerusalem about 80 years to this point. So altogether, it's about 140 or so years. And Nehemiah hadn't even been born when the rebellion that led them into exile, that caused God to send his judgment against them, had even been committed. And yet, as a leader, Nehemiah is identifying with the problem so he can be part of the solution. All too often, the tendency of those in leadership is to shirk responsibility, deflect blame, and point fingers. Amen? So many times, people in leadership, all they're worried about is protecting their own position, protecting their own paycheck, not letting anybody blame them. Don't we see this demonstrated all the time? Note the blame shifting that's been going on this past week over the situation in Afghanistan. Everybody blaming each other. This tendency is as old as the human race. In Genesis chapter 3, right after we read how the serpent tempted the first man and woman and they chose to rebel against God, and God calls them all into his courtroom. The man blames the woman. The woman blames the serpent. And the serpent didn't have any legs to stand on. Quit playing the blame game. Restoration cannot take place until somebody is willing to take responsibility. And in confessing this sin and identifying with it, Nehemiah was identifying clearly the causes that had led to the present predicament. And through his confession, Nehemiah was identifying with his people so he could intercede on their behalf. And for Nehemiah, this was not a you problem, and it wasn't a me problem, it was a we problem. And we need more leaders who are willing to do that. He was also a student of the scripture. In verse 8, remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. These are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. So while making his confession to God, and most people probably don't even notice this when they first read it, Nehemiah revealed he was aware of what God had said in his word about this situation. He directly quotes from Moses. In verse 8, he quotes from Leviticus 26, verse 33, almost verbatim. And in verse 9, he quotes from Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 2 through 4. That tells us Nehemiah knew the word. The fact that he could recall these words in his prayer so casually and so closely to the text indicates more than likely he had committed those words to memory. In rebuilding the house of God, we need leaders who do more than pay lip service to God's word. We need leaders who are students of the word, who learn the word and apply the word to their lives and to the situations they're trying to lead in. We also need leaders who are willing to take on the hard task. In verse 11, he says, O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name. And make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. Now, I was a cupbearer to the king. So then he goes on to say, and it came about in the month Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why is your face sad though you're not sick? There's nothing but sadness of heart. And then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Now, throughout this prayer that we just read a moment ago, Nehemiah indicated a willingness to be used by God to address the problems of his people. And he identifies himself in verse 11 as the Lord's servant. I'm your servant, Lord. He asks God for success. God, grant your servant success. Now think about this. If he is asking God to grant him success, that suggests Nehemiah has a plan. He's identified with the problem, and he's got a plan. There's one obstacle that stood in Nehemiah's way, the king. Nehemiah asked God to grant him compassion before this man. And then he dramatically reveals who this man was. I am the cupbearer of the king. That's the man who he needs to have God change the heart of. Now, this would be a daunting task because Nehemiah would have to face the most powerful man in the known world at that point, the king of Persia. It would also be a dangerous task Because if you remember when we were looking at Ezra chapter 4 and we talked about the opposition that the refugees ran into, and you know, the compiler of Ezra lists all these different occasions where the neighbors of Judah had ganged up on them. The very last incident he mentions was an attempt to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem under King Artaxerxes. So after they rebuilt the temple and resumed the sacrifices, they decided to turn their attention to the walls of the city. They started rebuilding the walls. All of the neighbors got upset and filed a grievance with the king. Basically, it was like a zoning dispute. They filed a lawsuit to stop the work. They wrote a letter to the king and said, King Artaxerxes, if you don't do something, I mean, these Jews are getting ready to rebuild the wall in this city. You know what's going to happen as soon as they build that wall? They're going to rebel against you. And you're going to lose all that revenue. And they're going to influence a lot of other people to, you know, you let one of these groups go, then all the groups are going to want to go. So you need to step in and do something about it. And Artaxerxes did. And he stepped in and he stopped the building project. This was just a few years, just a couple of years before this incident we're reading now. He stopped the building project, and the implication is that the work that had been done was torn down. And so now Nehemiah is going to go before this man and say, King, about that wall in Jerusalem, he has taken his life in his own hands here. A lot of people would have shirked away from taking that risk, but Nehemiah didn't. He stepped out courageously, and he stepped out in faith. He was willing to risk his position and even his life to seek a solution to this problem. And in doing so, he was dependent on God for success. In verse 4, he comes to the king. He doesn't mention this king right away. He's looking for the right opportunity. Okay, he's got a plan. He's waiting for the door to open. He's serving the king. King notices, hey, Nehemiah, something's bothering you. I mean, he tells you something about the relationship that it tells you something about Artaxerxes' character, that he would be that close to the help. But it also reveals something about the relationship, that he would know Nehemiah enough to notice something was off. And different scholars interpret this different ways. Some people look at this, you know, when he says, I was afraid because I've not been sad in the presence of the king, a lot of people say, well, you know, that's because his job was to make the king happy. So you don't come into the king's presence acting all depressed and sad, because that would bring the king down and that could be hazardous to your health. No. And that's a possibility. Other people think that, no, he intentionally was kind of moping around, hoping the king would notice and would ask him what's going on. And that would open the door. Who knows? He doesn't really explain that clearly. But what he does tell us is that when the king asks him, what would you request? What does he do? He shoots a prayer up the hotline to heaven, because he is dependent upon God. In verse 4, the king said, would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So he takes on this dangerous responsibility, but he is leaning on God for success. And we need more leaders who will depend on God instead of depending necessarily on their own gifts and talents. God does some of his best work with broken tools. We've seen a problem, though, in the last several years. A lot of people with a lot of gifts and a lot of skills, but their character caught up with them. And no matter how gifted and how skilled they are, they end up sabotaging their own ministry, and a lot of people getting hurt in churches because people outran their character or tried to. All the gifts and skills in the world, all the charisma, all the competence in the world cannot make up for bad character. Nehemiah was aware that if he was going to be successful in this, he needed to be in tune with God. So when the opportunity opens, he's trusting in the Lord to make this happen. We also need leaders who are prepared and ready to move when the right door opens. Verse 6, then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the house of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house which I am to go to. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. When King Artaxerxes asked Nehemiah detailed questions about this venture, Nehemiah was ready with detailed answers. Now, why do you think that was? Why do you think Nehemiah was ready to answer these questions? Could it be that while he was waiting these several weeks for the opportunity to speak to the king. He hadn't just been sitting idly, but he had been planning and preparing for just this moment. See, all too often, we sit around, we ask for God's help, and we just wait till we hope the answer is just going to drop down out of the sky into our laps. And sometimes it does. But most of the time, I think we should follow what Jesus tells us to do in Matthew chapter 7. We ask, but we also seek, and we knock. I think Nehemiah, after he asked God to help him, after he asked God to open this door, he went out seeking, and he went out knocking to get ready. As we set out to rebuild the house of God here in our community, we need people who will answer the call and step up to set the pace. We need leaders who are competent, who have the skills and the insight to come up with plans and the strategies and to carry them out. We need leaders with charisma, that intangible quality to inspire their people to join in the task and see it through to completion. But most importantly, we need leaders with character. People who love God and seek to reflect God's glory by the way they conduct themselves and by the way they interact with other people. Nehemiah shows us all three. We need some modern day Nehemiahs to step up to do things like leading small groups, to lead ministry teams, to lead committees, as we work together to make an impact on this community. If God opens the door, are you prepared to step through? And what are you doing right now to be ready when that invitation comes?
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.